You're listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.
It's been the longest 4 and a bit months, a cold, cold spring after a very dark winter. But today there is light. After 150 plus days of lockdown, we can perhaps begin to hope that things are getting better. Grandparents can hug their children and grandchildren again for the first time in 14 months. Many haven't even seen each other in that time. Three people who are vaccinated can meet for cuppas and chats inside. We can welcome six people or three households to our gardens again. And for the shops, which are the backbone of our economy and who have put their blood, sweat and tears into their businesses, they can open their shutters again from today. The Grizzly Adams look is no more. Hairdressers and personal services are open. Thousands of other shops are too, for click and collect, and open fully again from next Monday. Our libraries, museums, galleries will have people inside again. Churches, synagogues and mosques will welcome their faithful back. Up to 15 people can train outside. Well, throughout the programme, we will hear from people across all of these groups who are fervently hoping that this is the beginning of the end, all the while remembering the 7,068 people on the island who have paid the ultimate price. We're joined this morning by Mairead Owens, who is Dublin City Librarian, Ian Madden, CrossFit Trainer in Greystones in County Wicklow, and Father Pat O'Donnell, Parish Priest and of Rathmore in County Kerry. You're all very welcome and good morning to you. Mairead, I'll start with you. How are you feeling this morning?
Oh, good morning, Rachel. Really excited. Counting down the hours at this stage now to 10 o'clock and so nice to be actually able to physically welcome people back into the library spaces in the next few hours.
Father Pat, what about you? How are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm delighted. It's great to welcome people back because, like in every form of life, we've missed them and they've missed the gathering because that's at the heart of what we are as church, people gathering together. And you know, I'm sure like in your own lives, Zoom meetings were great and they had their value, but there's nothing like meeting people and being with people.
Absolutely. And Pat, for you to have people in your church again and not just for funerals.
Oh, yeah. You know, you hit the nail on the head there. For our ministry, for the last few months, it's been really our contact with people has been totally with funerals. And it's a valuable time. But, you know, at a human level, too, you just need the variety. But I must say, through streaming, we do lots of contact with people. But, again, it's not the same.
Mairead, will you take us through what we can do in our libraries from today?
Sure. I mean, the local authorities now are desperately trying to breathe life back into local communities all over the whole country. So from Donegal down to Cork, Galway to Dublin, the libraries will open at about 10 o'clock this morning and the public will be welcomed in to browse. So they can come in and choose a book, DVD, CD. We would ask them not to stay too long and then they leave. Hopefully over the next few weeks then, you know, as more people are vaccinated and we build up a confidence, we may be able to increase service. But at the moment, it's literally returning and borrowing items from their local library, but also doing the online digital content that we've been doing during COVID.
Well, we are joined now by Ian Madden, Ian's CrossFit trainer in Greystones in Wicklow. Ian, how are you feeling this morning?
Good. Yeah, look, it's great to be back. It's finally great to be back open in some kind of fashion. We're working around kind of maybe at half capacity an outdoor facility at the moment, but all going well, we should be back in by June 7th.
Great stuff. So what will you be doing today with your customers, your clients?
Well, we've had to set up sort of individualized training sessions. So the way it's worked out is we have to kind of have individualized equipment, individualized space and cleaning stations. So what we're going to do is see a return to kind of some sort of training that's a little bit better than what we've been doing online.
Because I presume the people who you work with, Ian, need a lot of motivation to keep at what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen a big fall off during this last 12 weeks. I think people had really grown fed up with the online situation. So, we've seen a huge fall off in the last 12 weeks in terms of people's attitude towards training online, and I think there's a big appetite to get back into inside the building, you know.
And Father Pat, are you, I mean, you've been here before in the sense that churches were open before the lockdown again in December. Are you confident that things can get back safely?
Oh, yeah, I really am. And because our systems are in place and there's a huge level of volunteers that ensure that people are safe. And I think that's what gave people confidence, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just think the increase in the number of going to funerals is going to be huge because, ironically, you know, we celebrate, as you mentioned at the start, parents and grandkids being able to get together. But when it was down to 10, it was the grandkids were left outside the door. So in a way, they were separated in life and death. And that's going to be huge, huge for people.
Yeah, the numbers go up to 50 from today for funerals and weddings, which mm-hmm. is a substantial increase.
Oh, yeah.
And communions and confirmations, though, they still can't happen.
Yeah, and not at present. And I suppose at present would mean whenever the health authorities deem that can happen. So I'd say in a lot of cases it will go out until the autumn. But again, mm-hmm. that creates a backlog in the autumn when all the weddings that were cancelled, when everything, baptisms, our communions and everything. So we don't think too much ahead until September from a work point of view.
Mairead, from your point of view as a librarian, I mean, people have been very patient and you all have been very patient and have been through an awful time over the last year and a bit. You must be looking forward to just getting new books out on the shelves.
Oh, you've no idea, Rachel. I mean, we've been buying new books. We start in January every year. So certainly from Dublin, we have an amazing collection out in Cabra with the vans all, I suppose, loaded up and ready to go. So the deliveries will start this morning. Now, we have been, as I said, doing the online service. So people have been able to borrow online, you know, e-books and audiobooks and reading magazines. But I think at this stage, a bit like Ian and Pat are saying, you know, people are tired of Zoom. They want something other than the, you know, the digital content. And nothing beats the physicality of holding a book or a storybook in your hand and the smell of a new book, which I'm looking forward to myself. So, good and ready to go, absolutely.
And Ian, do you dare to hope that this is the beginning of the end, that once you get back up and running today and then from next month to resume indoor training individually, that there's no going back?
Yeah, look, I mean, I don't think there's even an option at this stage to go backwards because the last figures we looked at, 66% of the nation were encroaching on a level of obesity, and I think mental health is really suffering, and I think exercise and fitness is really, really going to be important to the health of the nation. So what we, I suppose, would like to see is not only a return to fitness, but also maybe a recognition from the government that how important it is for the health of the nation, and maybe we could be reclassified as an essential service, you know.
And from a financial point of view, Ian, was the last year and a bit very hard?
It was, yeah, because we were stuck in the middle. A lot of industries that were closed entirely were getting grant funding, but with the fitness industry servicing online, we saw maybe a 50% fall off in revenue, which essentially wasn't enough to put us into the category of grant funding. So, yeah, it's been a struggle. It's been a real struggle to meet bills and also to incentivize staff to stay on. A lot of staff in the fitness industry have moved to other industries in search of work. So people who couldn't wait, people with families, have moved to maybe working in a Lidl or working in a Tesco. So there'll be big challenges for us to get staff to return, and I'm sure there'll be big challenges for gyms in terms of reopening costs, you know.
Well, look, good luck to you all today and enjoy the day. And thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning. That's Ian Madden, CrossFit trainer in Greystones, Mairead Owens, Dublin City librarian, and Father Pat O'Donnell, parish priest of Rathmore in County Kerry.
As we've been hearing, the computer systems that help to run the country's hospitals and healthcare services have been hit by a major cyber attack. Because of this, the HSE has had to shut down its systems. The chief executive of the HSE, Paul Reid, told us that the attack was human operated and very sophisticated. Well, news is emerging all the while, but for an update, let's talk to our reporter, Sinead Spain. Sinead, at this stage, what do we know?
We know that sometime during the night, the HSE became aware of a major cybersecurity attack impacting national and local systems and affecting core systems across the HSE. A major incident response has been put in place. All records have been shut down as a precaution. The National Security Cyber Team has been alerted, and this involves the Gardaí, the Defence Forces and the IT partners that work with the HSE and that build their system. We know that the attack impacts all patient records, so it was an attack on the data rather than on the machinery, so life-saving equipment is not impacted by this. And the CEO of the HSE, Paul Reid, says that we will know more later, but he has described it as a massive attack.
We have been the subject of a very significant major ransomware attack. It's quite a very sophisticated attack, and that will be just a kind of standard attack. So it's very sophisticated. It is impacting all of our national and local systems that would be involved in all of our core services. We did become aware of it during the night, and we've been obviously acting on it straight away. The immediate priority is obviously to contain this, but it is what we call a kind of human-operated ransomware attack, where they would seek to get access to data. And obviously, you know, seek a ransom for it. So it's quite a significant one, quite a serious one. We've taken a precautionary measure to shut down a lot of our major systems to protect them. We have sought and have already got the support of the national security and IT systems. We are working with all of our major IT security providers, and the national security cyber team are involved. They have been alerted. You know, so that would be the major state supports, including Garda, Defence Forces and third-party cyber support teams. So obviously we do apologise for the impacts of what it's had, but we are at the very early stages of fully understanding the threat, the impacts and trying to contain.
That was Paul Reid, the chief executive of the HSE, talking to us a short time ago. Sinead, do we know how many patients or hospitals are likely to be affected today?
We don't know at this stage, but what we do know is, as we heard there, it is a widespread and significant attack. So the HSE says they will begin to alert patients in the next hour or so when they know more about the extent of it, but we would expect widespread cancellations. The Rotunda Hospital in Dublin has cancelled all of its outpatient appointments, and people are asked, in particular for the Rotunda, do not attend unless it is an emergency. The only exception is for anyone who is 36 weeks pregnant or in case of emergency. And Professor Fergal Malone had this advice this morning for women with appointments today.
It basically means that we've had to shut down all of our computer systems. Now, thankfully, we have contingency plans in place for this, that the hospital can function absolutely normally using a paper-based system. But obviously, throughput will be much slower. So all patients in the hospital are safe. All the care is being provided. There's no problems for patient safety. But as a precaution, we're asking all patients who have appointments at the Rotunda today to not attend the hospital unless it's an emergency or unless they're 36 weeks pregnant or over. All equipment such as that are all absolutely operational and fine. It's computers logging into electronic healthcare records. That is the issue.
And that was Professor Fergal Malone of the Rotunda Hospital in Dublin. Our thanks to Sinead Spain for that report. By the way, one area we know that hasn't been affected is the COVID vaccination system. So at the moment, the news is that vaccinations will go ahead today as normal. Let's talk now to Brian Honan, who's a cybersecurity expert and former special advisor on cybersecurity to Europol. Brian, thanks very much for talking to us. Let's start with the basics. What is a ransomware attack?
Yeah, good morning, Rachel. A ransomware attack is where criminals use a computer virus to infect your computers. And once they trigger the virus, it encrypts or scrambles all your data so that you can't access it. And then they demand a ransom, an extortion fee from you to give you the password to recover your data from. So it's an attack where they make your information unavailable and literally hold it to ransom.
And from what we've been hearing over the past hour or so since this story broke, what do you make of what's happening here?
Yeah, look, this is a major attack by all accounts. It's heartening to hear from Paul Reid and HSE and the chief to return to hospital how their business continuity plans have been able to kick in and that they're able to continue ordinary operations, albeit at a slower pace because it is paper-based, and that they've taken systems offline as a precaution to stop the ransom virus spreading any further within the systems. So they've taken the proactive and positive steps, and hopefully the attack can be contained and dealt with over the next few days. But look, we have seen this happen in other countries. The people behind these attacks are criminals. Their only motive is to make money. They don't care who they impact or who they hurt. And they've hit hospitals in other countries. They've hit health services in other countries, education services, etc. And, you know, I think it does say a lot about the type of people who conduct these attacks that they do this type of stuff to hospitals and healthcare in the middle of a pandemic.
So is it likely then that the people behind this, that they will be getting in touch in some way with the HSE to say, listen, this is what we've done and this is what we're looking for?
Yeah, that's typically how it works, is that there may be looking to contact the HSE in some way. Typically, it's a message left on one of the impacted machines. It'll give them details of an email address to contact that they can communicate with the criminals, or a website that they can go to communicate with them through that. And it'll probably contain the ransom demand as to how much money they're looking for and how they expect to be paid, which will be generally through cryptocurrencies, typically something like Bitcoin, etc., to transfer the money over to them.
How can this be resolved?
There are several ways you can resolve it. If you're lucky, your backups are up to date and haven't been affected by the criminals. Sometimes what the criminals do is when they access your network, they will spend time on your network and corrupt your backups so that when they do trigger the ransomware software, that it you go to recovery backups, it's not there. So if, you know, as I said, hopefully the backups have not been impacted and the data can be restored from that. If the backups have been impacted, then the options are to not pay the ransom and rebuild your systems from scratch as best you can. Or unfortunately, a decision may have to be made whether or not to pay the ransom to try to get the data back. But we should be very wary. You are dealing with criminals. By their nature, they're not the most trustworthy people in the world. And there's no guarantee, even if you pay the ransom, that you will get your data back, or that if you pay the ransom, that there's no additional costs or impact on the information that as a result of the attack.
Just one final question, Brian. We're talking here, in some cases, about quite sensitive information. Is there a danger that people's data, their personal information, has been compromised?
Yeah. Yeah, there is, Rachel. Some of the criminal gangs, they do what's called a double extortion attack. So your information is held to ransom by the ransomware and you need to pay to get it back. And then the criminals also threaten to release the data they've got during the attack onto the internet, and they will demand a payment for that to prevent that from happening. And we've seen a case of recently in Finland where a psychiatric hospital was impacted by such an attack that their data was ransomed, the payment was demanded to release their data, and also payment demanded not to post the data onto the internet.
Brian, thank you very much. And of course, I should say that at this moment, it's entirely unclear whether anything like that has happened or will happen. But as Brian was saying to us there, it's a possibility. That was Brian Honan, cybersecurity expert and former special advisor on cybersecurity to Europol. At least 67 people have now been killed in Gaza and 7 in Israel during an upsurge in violence. Yesterday, Israeli airstrikes felled another multi-story building in Gaza, while Hamas militants launched dozens of rocket attacks on Israel. There was also further violence in areas of Israel with mixed Jewish and Arab populations. Israeli police said that more than 370 people had been arrested. Benny Gantz, Israel's defence minister, said last night that his country was not preparing for a ceasefire. We were talking earlier on the programme to Dr. Yasser Abu Jamal, who's director of Gaza Community Mental Health Programme. And as you might know, if you were listening to us then, the line went down. But he's been telling us how people are very frightened and fearful of leaving their homes.
The number of people who got killed are more than 70 people, including 17 children and 7 women. The bombardment entailed civilian buildings, it entailed governmental and police buildings, various apartments that are here and there, and no one really knows what's going to happen. People are just reminded of the atrocities that took place during the previous attacks in 2008, 9, 2012, and 2014, and people are worried, not sure what's going to happen next.
Dr. Yasser Abu Jamal speaking to us from Gaza. Belle True is the Middle East correspondent of the London Independent. She joins us on the line. Thanks for talking to us this morning. What's the situation there at the moment?
Well, we've got these sort of two different conflicts happening simultaneously, the cross-border flare-up between Palestinian militants and Israeli army, which has left, you know, very high death toll in Gaza and also 7 killed in Israel. But at the same time, we're seeing extraordinary wave of violence across multiple cities internally within Israel between Arab and Jewish citizens, with horrific footage of near lynchings being shared by different media outlets. And as you said, the police force having arrested hundreds of people. So it feels extremely on edge, and at the same time there doesn't seem to be any way of being able to de-escalate either conflict, which is kind of fueling each other. So it feels incredibly bleak at the same time.
This is the worst violence in 7 years. People may remember the summer of 2014. Why is this happening now?
Well, this has been arguably the accumulation or the crescendo of weeks and weeks of tensions that have simmered largely around the contested city of Jerusalem, which is claimed by both sides as their capital. It arguably started at the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan with some contentious decisions that were taken by Israeli security forces, including blocking off areas of Damascus Gate, which is into the old city, and also storming Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the third holiest site in Islam. And the Israeli police say they did that because of violence from Palestinian protesters. That was basically the kind of touch paper moment that triggered what we're seeing right now. But this is coming off the back of, you know, a lot of anger on both sides that has been bubbling away for not just the last few weeks, but probably the last year. The sort of final kind of crescendo was Hamas militants essentially firing rockets on Jerusalem after the video footage of Israeli forces storming Al-Aqsa. That was a red line crossed for the Israelis, and then we saw this cross-border flare-up. But in terms of what's happening in the cities between Arab and Jewish citizens of Israel, this is the accumulation of not just weeks, but, you know, years, decades of grievances, of anger, of mistrust, of growing division within the country, of growing levels of racism. And it's all coming out right now because of these extraordinary scenes and red lines that have been crossed.
And as far as the airstrikes and the missiles are concerned, there's a grim familiarity to this, isn't there? Because whenever this happens, there are always a large number of civilian casualties, particularly among Palestinians.
Yes, I mean, sadly, the people who pay the highest price for this, of course, are the civilians. And the death toll tends to be, is always much higher in Gaza because, you know, civilians don't have access to bomb shelters, and there isn't a warning system in place, a Palestinian, you know, rocket siren warning system that they have in Israel. Although the Israeli military make it very clear that they often do give warnings to residents within high-rise buildings, for example, before they strike them, to let them leave the building before the strike happens. But ultimately, as I said, the civilians pay the highest price, and, you know, among them are our families, our children, our women, and this is the biggest problem here, is that we're going to see more and more people be killed. And at the same time, there doesn't appear to be any way of de-escalating this. It doesn't seem to be any way of being able to shift towards a ceasefire, even a temporary one, or a long-term kind of larger peace deal.
We heard on our news bulletin a few minutes ago, Joe Biden, President Biden, saying that he was optimistic that this could be resolved in the short term. But from what you and others have been saying, there doesn't really seem to be much basis for that sort of optimism.
Well, I would love to have the optimism that he's shown, but I really can't see how that could happen anytime soon. I still believe personally that I don't think either side is interested in an all-out protracted conflict, because it is devastating for both sides, particularly for the Palestinian side in terms of the extraordinary death toll from the 2014 war. And I also think it doesn't sound that optimistic. It doesn't sound that realistic when we look at some of the statements coming from either side. So, for example, the Israeli military said this morning that they were drafting plans for a possible ground invasion. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to happen. This is a one step towards it potentially happening. It then has to be, once it's drafted by the military, has to be approved by the political leadership, and then there actually has to be a decision to go in. But that's certainly not a sign of de-escalation. From the Gazan side, there has been a statement saying that they would potentially be interested in some kind of ceasefire, but that's been rejected. And anyway, it's hard to see what terms that ceasefire would be on, like what either side could offer each other to come back from this. And even if there is a ceasefire stopping, cross-border barrages of rockets and airstrikes, you have the internal conflict within Israel, which is extraordinary and pushing towards a kind of protracted civil conflict. So unfortunately, with these levels of violence, these levels of conflict layering on top of each other, it's hard to see how we're going to have a peaceful resolution to this crisis.
Beltrú, thank you very much indeed for taking our call this morning. Beltrú, who's the Middle East correspondent with the London Independent.
It was August 1971, Belfast, West Belfast, Ballymurphy. Over 3 days, a mother of eight, a Catholic priest, two 19-year-olds, one of whom was about to become a dad for the second time, were among 10 people shot dead during a British Army operation. Those who died were Joan Connolly, Father Hugh Mullen, Frank Quinn, Noel Phillips, Daniel Teggart, Joseph Murphy, John Laverty, Joseph Corr, Edward Doherty and John McKerr. Today, a coroner will deliver her findings into their deaths. Their families are hoping for truth and justice. At the very least, they are hoping that their loved ones will be cleared of any accusation by the British that they were members of the IRA. Our Northern editor, Vincent Kearney, reports.
Father Hugh Mullen swapped the tranquil village of Portaferry on the shores of Strangford Loch in County Down for the chaos and mayhem of West Belfast in August 1971. His gravestone in the grounds of St Patrick's Church in Portaferry says he died serving his people in Ballymurphy.
And that night, about, I think it was the 10 o'clock news on RTE, and they said that there was a priest had been shot in Ballymurphy.
Almost half a century later, standing by the grave, tears well in the eyes of his 81-year-old brother Patsy, as he recalls that night.
We were all in a terrible state, I can tell you. Still are. We still are in a bad way.
The 38-year-old priest was killed after going to help a parishioner.
There had been a lot of trouble that day, and people were trying to get away from the trouble. They were carrying children across the wasteland in front of his house, and there was shooting going on. He was standing at his front door in front of that wasteland, and someone called for a priest that someone had been shot.
Geraldine McGrattan is his niece.
He brought a white flag with him, waving the white flag. Before he had gone out, he rang the army and told them that he was going out onto the wasteland. He got to the injured man and he spoke to him and gave him a blessing, and then was starting to head back to get an ambulance to come and help the man. When he was shot, with the first shot, he went down and then he was shot again.
The families of the 10 people killed during the three-day period examined by these inquests refer to the incident as the Ballymurphy Massacre. While the Lawless Paramilitary Group, the UVF, recently claimed that its members may have been responsible for some of the killings, the families believe all 10 victims were shot by members of the British Army's Parachute Regiment. Geraldine McGrattan says their grief was compounded by false claims that all of those killed were armed members of the IRA.
We were not only filled with grief, but we were filled with the not knowing what had happened, why it had happened, then you get the anger that there's something, this is unjust, and nobody is doing anything about it. No one is saying it's unjust.
The day after Father Mullen was killed, 20-year-old John Laverty, one of a family of 12 children, carried his 8-year-old sister Carmel to the local community centre to catch a bus evacuating women and children from the area to Kildare Army Camp.
John told me that everything was going to be okay. I was going on a wee holiday, and when I came back, everything would be back to normal. And as an 8-year-old, I could sense the fear of my family and the fear of my neighbours.
Carmel never spoke to her brother again. The day after she was taken to safety, he died after being shot in the back. 50 years later, the sense of pain and anger is clear, and she wants those responsible to be held to account.
There has to be accountability. You know, you can't come in and totally destroy a family, fracture a family that will never recover, and the other families, and have no accountability from the state. You know, when the lawmakers become the lawbreakers, then there's no law.
Solicitor Padraig O'Murray backed the family's campaign for these inquests and represented them during the hearings. He believes the findings will back their accounts of what happened.
We're hoping for the first time in 50 years for an evidence-based narrative of what happened in Ballymurphy in August 1971. I'm absolutely confident that these findings will vindicate what the families have said from day one, that their loved ones were innocent, that they weren't gunmen and gunwomen. I'm absolutely 100% confident about that.
The families of Father Hugh Mullen, John Laverty and the other 8 victims are confident he's right.
The British state had fought us every step of the way to try to deny us justice. On Tuesday they will not be able to do that.
Yeah, it's the truth. All we're interested in is truth. We need truth. And I'm thinking and I hope that everything will work out well for all the families in Ballymurphy. They're all good people. All good people.
Patsy Mullen, and before him, Carmel Laverty, siblings of 2 of 10 people shot dead in Ballymurphy in West Belfast 50 years ago this coming August. Their inquest findings will be delivered later today by the coroner. That was our Northern editor, Vincent Kearney, reporting there, and we'll have more on this story throughout the programme.
Entirely innocent of all wrongdoing, families and friends of 10 people shot dead in West Belfast 50 years ago were welcomed home to Ballymurphy last night to cheers, tears and relief after the longest ever inquest in Northern Ireland found that the deaths of 10 people killed in 3 days in August 1971 after the introduction of internment without trial were unjustified. That 9 people were shot dead by British soldiers: Joan Connolly, Father Hugh Mullen, Frank Quinn, Noel Phillips, Daniel Taggart, Joseph Murphy, John Laverty, Joseph Corr and Edward Doherty. Justice Siobhan Keegan couldn't make a finding on who shot John James McCurr because of what she described as an abject failure to investigate at the time. An 11th victim, Pat McCarthy, died of a heart attack. The British Army had falsely claimed that all were armed members of the IRA. The coroner said that she was quite convinced Father Hugh Mullen was a peacemaker and that he was carrying a white object at the time that he was shot after he went to help a wounded man who called for help. His niece, Geraldine McGrattan, is with us now. Geraldine, good morning and thank you very much for taking our call today after what I can only imagine was a very long and emotional day yesterday. How are you this morning?
I am very tired, but I'm still in awe of what happened yesterday and all the wonderful things Justice Keegan said about my uncle.
Do yesterday's findings help you and your family to come to terms with what happened 50 years ago?
I think they give us peace. For 50 years, we have carried the anger and the hurt that he was killed. We didn't know exactly what had happened to him. We didn't know why he had been killed or how he had been killed. And now everything has been explained to us. We know now that the British Army fired with a disproportionate force into the area where he was. So it does it brings a kind of peace that everyone now knows that he was totally innocent of. He wasn't a gunman. He was a good man going out to help another wounded person and waving a white flag.
And how do you reflect on what Justice Keegan said about your uncle?
It was so good to hear her say that he was a peacemaker. We knew from the inquest that he had walked the streets during the evenings, trying to calm situations, putting himself at risk, but he had done it. He had talked to army, he had talked to young people. He had really tried very hard to keep things calm. During that day of the 9th of August, he had rang the army a couple of times to say how bad things were around the area where he lived. He had worked so hard to do it, and to hear her say that was truly wonderful for us. Then to hear her describe his wounds and how he had died, that was difficult to hear. But to hear the innocent, entirely innocent, and the disproportionate force by the army, it was hard to hear. It was hard to hear that they had just let loose. But it was good to get the truth out into the public domain.
Your uncle was very young at the time. You were very young at the time. How do you remember your Uncle Hugh?
Well, I was 18 when he died. He was 38. My mother was 39. We were a very close-knit family. We come from a small village on the shores of Strangford Loch. So, you know, my granny and my granddad, my uncles, everyone was in and out of each other's houses. My uncle was home most weeks from his parish for dinner. I'm the eldest grandchild, so I was always in my granny's. We would have had, you know, family dinners. My mother sang. My uncle played the guitar. He loved to sail. He loved to swim. He loved to try to teach us how to do both. He really enjoyed young people. He enjoyed being in our company. He loved his sister and brothers. He was a family man. He loved people. People liked him.
Geraldine, what do you want to happen now? Do you want the man who shot him to be prosecuted?
Well, the army did not give much information, as you would have read from the findings yesterday. We only know that it was soldiers from Two Para or Three Queens who fired the shots, but we don't really have any one particular soldier. So I think really it's now up to our legal team to decide what the next step would be. At the moment, I am happy, I am at peace that we have got the truth out, that his name is cleared and he has been named as a peacemaker rather than a gunman. I'm content today, and now I just want to reflect on what was said yesterday and to thank God for the 38 years that he was here and that we had him.
Geraldine McGrattan, we really appreciate you speaking to us this morning. That's Geraldine McGrattan, whose uncle Hugh Mullen, father Hugh Mullen, was among those killed by the British Army in Ballymurphy in 1971.
New legislation published yesterday would allow for adopted people to get access to their birth certs, even if a parent indicates they don't wish to be identified. It's a change in the law that's been sought by adopted people in Ireland for decades. Bláthnaid Hurley was adopted from Bessborough, a mother and baby home in County Cork. Last night she spoke to our reporter Joan O'Sullivan about what the possibility of finally getting access to her real birth certificate means to her.
I'm actually overwhelmed. I am in tears, and I'm not normally a very emotional person, but I'm experiencing something that I never thought I would live to see. I never thought that I would get the right to have a birth certificate the same as most people that I know who live in this country have. I thought I would forever have a piece of paper that really doesn't tell the truth about me. It says I was born in Dublin and I wasn't. I was born in Cork, and there's lots of other inconsistencies in there. But the fact that I now have the same rights as everybody else is just, it's completely overwhelming.
Why is it so important to get a real birth certificate?
It's almost like a recognition that you're a real person, that you're a real citizen of this country, that you too can now stand up and hold your head high and have the same rights and prove who you are to everybody else. Because up until now, you only have the documentation that you've been allowed have, and you don't know whether the information that's on those documents is true. I really thought at this stage in my life that I would never get to hold a birth certificate. And now I know there are a few more hoops and whatever for it to go through for the legislation to be passed. But for the first time ever in my life, there seems to be real hope that this is what's actually going to happen.
The legislation is also going to provide a pathway by which people may be able to get in contact with their relatives. What do you think about that?
I like the idea that the pathway is there for those who wish to go that way. But I also like the fact that there is a caveat in there that if somebody doesn't want to be traced for whatever reason, and it's their personal reason, I think they should have the right to be able to say that they want to hold on to their privacy and they don't want somebody unannounced turning up at their door. For me personally, that was never my main goal. If my mother is still alive and if she or any of my family are still there and wish to make contact or wish to be contacted by me, I would be more than happy to do that. But I would never impose myself into somebody else's life.
Bláthaín Hurley talking to Joan O'Sullivan. Minister Roderic O'Gorman has called his new legislation a compassionate, fair and balanced solution to an historic wrong. Minister O'Gorman, good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
A very emotional Bláthaín Hurley there, really setting out what it means to her to finally get access to her identity. But we were told that it couldn't be done, that it wasn't legally possible. What's the way forward that you've found?
Well, I think just listening to Bláthaín and I suppose the emotion that you can hear from her there, it does show for those of us who've had our birth certs all our life, I don't think we can understand the significance of being denied that. When I took on this role and when the Commission of Investigation reported in January, I made it clear that I wanted to secure full and unredacted access to birth certs and birth information for all adopted people, those who are boarded out, those who had their births illegally registered. And I said we'd look at GDPR and look at the impact the introduction in 2018 of GDPR had. And I've worked very closely with the Attorney General on that. And the existence of GDPR and central to GDPR is this idea that a person has a right to information about their own identity. And that's allowed us to, I suppose, rebalance those rights, the rights of the adopted person, the rights of the natural mother. And I believe we've done that in a way that ensures adopted people get the information that we believe they're entitled to, but also provides protections to the privacy rights of natural mothers as well. And I think, as we heard from Bláthaín, I think the vast majority of adoptees also wish to protect the privacy rights of their natural mother, okay, if that's the wish of their natural
parents.
Take us
through the steps here. First, on the part of adopted people, what information will they get? Will they have a right to get? And will they be getting the originals and not and copies of original papers and not an interpretation?
No,
of
absolutely
what was in that
not.
Paper?
No interpretation. They'll be provided with copies of the original documentation. As I say, nothing is being held back in this legislation. So it's the birth cert. itself, its birth information, which contains information that perhaps the natural father's name, which could have been on the birth cert but may not have been put on the birth cert. If that's in the file, that will be made available to them. Its care information, so for people who are boarded out, and I know Primetime did a programme on those a month or so ago, information about who they were in the care of, who put them in that care, the length of time they spent there. It also has early life information, so this often applies to people who are in institutions, so how long again were they there for, did anybody visit them during that time, any medical, vaccinations that were given to them during that period, and then medical information as well is provided under the legislation. And finally, if any mementos, if a letter or some object was left by a natural parent for an adopted person, and that's on file, that will be made available
as well. It's all very harsh that this has been denied, but there's something very poignant about mementos maybe left by a birth mother or a father, which they've never had access to, that they might now be looking at 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years later.
Yeah, and I think, I suppose that just reminds us of the very fraught history of adoption in this country and the incredibly difficult circumstances in which so many women gave their child up for adoption. And I suppose what we're trying to do, and I acknowledged yesterday, is that the state should have acted to provide this information years ago. And we have, I feel, failed as a state to do this. And we've let adopted people down by not doing this. And we're taking these steps now to provide adopted people with this vital information.
Does the state have access to all of the files, or will you still have to gather in or collect files from religious institutions?
The state doesn't have access to all files, and the protection of records is another central piece of this legislation. So under the legislation, I or future ministers will have the power to designate bodies, including private bodies, as information holders. And one of these designations will allow adopted people apply directly to these bodies for information. And we can also designate a body as a secondary information holder as well. And in that situation, we just place an obligation on them to protect the records that they have. But I've also said that I will be engaging with the religious congregations who ran the mother and baby institutions with a view to securing their records into state control.
Do you anticipate any difficulties in that regard, or would you use any compellability powers to get access to documents?
There are compellability powers under this legislation that we'll be passing. I'd hope that in recognition of, I suppose, reparation, recognition of trying to rebuild trust, just in the same way that the state is trying to rebuild trust now, I think these religious congregations have a similar duty, and I'd hope that they would see the provision of information as part of that.
Yeah, and what does your engagement with these institutions and religious organisations tell you? Does it tell you that they're going to cooperate, or does it tell you that you may, and adopted people accessing their information might encounter difficulty?
Look, first of all, I wrote to all the religious congregations after the commission report came out, indicating I wanted to discuss information, but also financial reparations as well. We made a decision not to meet with them until the interdepartmental group that is drawing together the redress scheme has reported, and its work is well underway and should be completed soon. I would hope that we'll be able to do this through a negotiation, but I think it is important to say that we do have powers provided in this legislation, if necessary. Yes, I think it is. It is absolutely important, because we've seen in all of this, information is key to what adopted people are looking for.
And I know adopted people have always wanted to create a separation, if you like, between their rights to their documents and then their birth parents' right to privacy. So what happens now when an adopted person wants access to information that a birth parent did not want to give, an identity they didn't want to be revealed?
Well, the legislation sets up a contact preference register where both adopted people and natural parents can register their preference. And if a natural parent registers a preference for contact or doesn't fill in the register at all the information will be immediately released to the adopted person once they apply. if the natural parent puts a no contact preference on the contact preference register, in that situation, the adopted person will undertake a information meeting with the social worker. And at that meeting, the parents, the natural parent's no contact preference will be conveyed to them. The importance of their parents' privacy rights will be discussed, and the importance of adhering to the no contact preference will be discussed. And after that, the full information will then be released to the adopted
person. But there's
no
penalty.
There's no penalty.
You're not criminalising this in any way.
No, and we made a conscious decision in previous legislation about maybe 20 years ago. There was a proposal in terms of a criminal sanction. I don't want to be criminalising adopted people.
Who's going to handle all of this, Minister?
This will be done through the Adoption Authority of Ireland and two SLESO.
You know, there's a lack of trust between some of the agencies who have been actively, you know, fighting for this information for a long time, and TUSLA.
I do, and I think a major element of that was TUSLA social workers legally couldn't provide people with information. So people were meeting with social workers and being told, we have information, but we can't give it to you, or we can only give it to you redacted. That won't happen anymore under this legislation.
All right, Minister, a final brief and a very different question to you. Your Green Party colleague, Stephen Matthews, yesterday said he was disappointed by comments Taoiseach had made about the Glanbia cheese factory in County Kilkenny. The Taoiseach saying he hoped Antashka wouldn't appeal a decision on planning beyond the High Court. Stephen Matthews saying there shouldn't be any involvement of politicians in live planning matters. Do you agree with your colleague?
Well, look, I think Antashka has an important role in terms of the planning process. It's a statutory role and it's provided for in the law. And I think they've had a long track record over the years in securing compliance with environmental standards. And I think Antashka are best placed to decide if they appeal a court decision.
Is that a butt out on Taoiseach?
I think it's best for legal processes to play out. And I would generally say politicians should leave them to play out.
Minister Roderick O'Gorman, thank you for coming in to us this morning.
Cities across the country, streets are being pedestrianised and restaurants are switching to outdoor seating, a move that's been welcomed by many to allow us to live a summer outdoors. But it also has its downsides. For instance, Jessica Nivuelon from Cork is blind and uses a cane. And Jessica's been telling our reporter Elise Sheehy about her concerns about the reopening of outdoor dining.
I'm excited about it because, you know, it'll be fantastic for us all to get back out and meet our friends and be able to sit down and have a meal. But I suppose as a cane user, I'm concerned about it. I suppose shared spaces outside, especially in terms of outdoor dining, can be quite difficult for a person like me who's blind. I use a long cane, which is the long white stick with the little ball at the end. And it can just be quite difficult to navigate somewhere that I'm used to, but somewhere that has now become cluttered, I suppose. It's quite difficult in terms of spaces that you would have been sure would have had like ample space to get through with your cane, that you wouldn't have been in danger of walking past something that might collide maybe with your head or your arm or your torso. I suppose that's going to be difficult because, you know, you'll have to navigate the edges of tables, chair legs that might stick out, table legs that might stick out. If people have handbags or, you know, shopping bags on the floor, that can be quite difficult. And I suppose it does kind of fill me with a bit of anxiety as well. Places that I would have normally used as my walking route, especially around Cork City, which has recently been pedestrianised again, that's quite concerning to me.
And Jessica, last year you did have some experience with walking through streets that had outdoor dining areas. What was that like?
It was quite difficult. I did walk into the edges of tables and chairs. I'm at the stage now where I'm going to avoid those areas altogether unless I have a sighted person with me.
Jessica Nivuelon talking to our reporter Elise Sheehy. And the National Council for the Blind is launching a Change Your View campaign to raise awareness about the impact of all these changes on the visually impaired. And June Tinsley, the head of advocacy at the National Council for the Blind, can tell us more. And June, tell us what the Change Your View campaign is all about and what steps can be taken to make the world a more accessible place for people like Jessica.
Good morning. Yes, the Change Your View campaign is really just to promote the realities of the unique challenges that face people who are blind and visually impaired now that the restrictions are easing. We know that there's going to be plenty more outdoor furniture on the streets and businesses are understandably trying to maximise their revenue. But I suppose it's just to be mindful that people who are familiar with those streets are now going to be at a disadvantage. So our advice really to businesses is to cordon off the sections that they are going to be using for outdoor space, for outdoor furniture, things like tables and chairs, sandwich boards, portable bins, all those kind of things. If they're easily cordoned off, it means that there's still enough width mm-hmm. on the path for an individual to pass by safely and that the furniture isn't becoming over-cluttered on the path. And I suppose other advice would be to make sure that the street furniture would contrast visually. It would be a different colour to the background of the where it's situated so that individuals who are visually impaired can spot it with a bit more ease. I suppose these measures are really to ensure that everybody can enjoy the fact that we are going to be celebrating an outdoor summer and to allay some of the concerns that are affecting the sight loss community at the minute.
And briefly, June, it's also about people showing consideration, isn't it, in the way we're all queuing on footpaths and using public space differently now?
Very much so. And I suppose, again, it's just to remind the public that for people who are blind or visually impaired, abiding by social distancing regulations is really, really difficult because they're not going to be able to gauge what a 2 metre distance is. They're not going to be necessarily able to see the new markings in shops or where the hand sanitisations are. And often people who are blind or visually impaired do not have a guide dog or do not necessarily use a cane. So it's a hidden disability. So we're calling on the public to give a little more space, to give verbal instruction to somebody that they feel they might need the assistance, to direct them to where the queue starts or to direct them where the hand sanitising stations are. Those kind of practical tips.
Good advice. June Tinsley, Head of Advocacy at the National Council for the Blind. Thank you.
And you think you've heard it all, and then something else comes along. This time it's people scooping ducklings out of canal water and selling them on Dublin streets. We're joined by Gillian Bird, Head of Education and Media at the DSPCA. Gillian, what's happening?
So we started getting reports yesterday of people saying that they had been offered ducklings for sale on the streets. We know that some people have actually gone out to buy ducklings. It seems to be a trend on social media where people are videoing sort of a day in the life of a duckling. And it's quite concerning for ourselves, the charity looking after these animals.
So what have you found out? They're scooping them out of the canal.
Well, there's been a mixture of both farmyard ducklings, which are the lovely little yellow ones, and brown ducklings. Some of them we think might be from different breeds of ducks, but we know we definitely have some that have come from the wild ducks that live in the canals and the ponds. So we suspect that what's happening is, it's caught on now that people know that people are going to buy ducklings. So if you go down to the canal, scoop up a few ducklings, they seem to be selling them for about €5 each.
And how are they doing that? Are they just going up to people on the street?
Yeah, we've had reports of young teenagers going up to other teenagers and sort of offering them a duckling for €5. We had one lady who actually went and bought 10 of them off some kids who were selling them. So it's one of these situations. And we're just really worried because where have they come from? Who's going to look after them? Are they going to be looked after properly? A family home living in your bathtub is not a good home for a duckling.
Why not?
Well, because basically, for a start, it takes up to 4 weeks for their feathers to become fully waterproof. So you end up with a situation where they get very, very cold. If they're not kept in the correct environment, like under a heat lamp or a heat pad, they've got to be kept warm. They've got to be fed properly. They also have a lifespan of between 7 and 15 years. So you're looking at something that what are people going to be doing with them long term?
Yeah, exactly. They grow into big ducks. And it, as you say, if it's for TikTok, boredom might set in and the challenges with what they do with the ducklings might get more cruel.
Yeah, and we've already seen, there's even a video on TikTok where somebody was saying, oh, I bought this duckling, it's a major mistake. I think I'll just release it down to the pond tomorrow. And obviously, these ducklings are very young. They should be with their parents. They should be looked after properly. And they're just going to get picked off by predators and they're going to die.
Okay, Gillian, thanks a million. Gillian Bird, Head of Education and Media at the DSPCA.
Now, an American woman travels to Ireland to buy land to build a resort, enters the local matchmaking festival to prove her investment, and meets local councillor and whiskey distiller Brennan O'Brien. You can probably guess where this is going. Yes, it's a film, it's American, and it's called As Luck Would Have It.
I knew you screwed up my soda bread. I was so careful.
I know. I'm sorry.
And you should have given me those points in hurling.
Still on the fence about that one.
Wait, what about Siobhan's class? Did you mess up my yarn?
No, that was all you.
Yes, it's on the Hallmark Channel. It's led to a flood of interest in the Listunvarna Matchmaking Festival, which didn't go ahead last year. Will it this year? More on that shortly. But first, here's Stephanie Rogerson from Seattle in Washington, who watched the movie recently and has been telling our reporter Ailey Sheehy about her plans to travel to Ireland for the Listunvarna Matchmaking Festival.
The Hallmark movie was about an American lady who had gone to Ireland on a business trip. And while she was there, the matchmaking festival was taking place. And they really showcased just this wonderful experience, everything from sporting events to learning how to make Irish soda bread or to knit, just to take in the different culture. And there was, you know, music and dancing and various speed dating. It just seemed so fun and so wholesome and just a nice breath of fresh air than what, you know, people are used to dating nowadays, swipe right, swipe left, all that good stuff. During the commercial, I grabbed my cell phone and I looked up international matchmaking festivals and was quite surprised to learn that this Hallmark movie was actually based off of the Listunvarna Matchmaking Festival. And so I immediately set out to see how I could get myself over there and who was putting it on, and found their Facebook page and made a contact with Julie Carr. And I'm just trying to learn as much about it as I can and hoping that they get to have the festival this year so I can attend in person.
Who would travel with you, or what plans do you have?
I had a 2-week European vacation planned last year that didn't get to happen because of COVID. So I've just kind of reselected the locations I'd be visiting. And I think I would spend at least a week in Ireland and then maybe go spend a couple more days in London and then take the channel over to Paris and get to see the Eiffel Tower.
And with the times we live in, with social media and all the dating apps and websites, why a matchmaking festival in Ireland?
Because it's something I haven't done before. And the gentleman who's been putting on the matchmaking festival and how it's been in his family for many years. And then I like that it's kind of a remote location. It's not necessarily centralized in a busy city. It just seemed different and just more wholesome to me.
So what would you hope for?
It would be nice to meet a variety of people, and always hoping to meet your love connection. I like trying new experiences, and in my hometown, I was voted the most friendliest person. So I'm always, you know, eager to make a new acquaintance and things along those lines. That's kind of where I'm at with that.
And Stephanie, what about your friends when you explained to them about this matchmaking festival in Ireland? What was their reaction?
Well, my friend Michelle's married, but she said she's always up for going on an adventure with me. She'll hold my purse while I do some speed dating. And then I have a couple other friends that I've reached out to, and they've told me to keep them posted and they'll see how things shake out.
Wholesome. That's Stephanie Rogerson from Seattle speaking to our reporter Ailey Sheehy. Let's speak to Julie Carr, Head of Marketing and PR for Listunvarna Matchmaking Festival. Good morning, Julie. Tell us about the interest in the festival coming from abroad in recent weeks.
And we've had a massive amount of interest since the film was released. We have about 25,000 people on our Facebook page, and there's been a few thousand extra people have, you know, requested to join. And we also have a private Facebook group. We've had loads of messages. Stephanie was one of the people that contacted me originally. She was very, very excited. And it's all really from America and from Canada that people are interested in coming. They actually couldn't believe that there was a real matchmaking festival. You know, as I say, like, Stephanie Googled it. They thought it was like it was something made up, so they were delighted to find out it actually existed. So it's fantastic publicity for us, you know, for the festival and for the area. And hopefully when travel opens up, we'll get lots of people travelling from America and from Canada.
This is it, Julie. I mean, the defence festival was cancelled last year because of COVID. Is it going to go ahead this year? And when will you know?
Well, we haven't decided yet whether it's going to go ahead. We're waiting on government guidelines, re-indoor gatherings, and we can't make that decision yet until it's clarified. It'll probably be in July when we make an announcement. I mean, Longitude was recently cancelled, so we're keeping a very, yes, you know, keen eye on developments. As you know, health and safety is our main priority. And we know that there was a large-scale event in Liverpool. There was a pilot event run in Sefton Park. So we were very interested to see what happened with that. And we've actually put a proposal in to the tourism minister, Catherine Martin, and Stephen Donnelly, you know, that we suggested that we could do something similar. So we're just waiting to hear back about that.
Let's see. Julie Carr, Head of Marketing and PR for the Listening Environment Matchmaking Festival. Thanks for speaking to us.
You've been listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.